It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk about the meaning of Ramadan.
But first, have you noticed more folks out on the bike path these days? Maybe more bikes chained up outside your office. Well, there are good reasons for that.
Our next guest says that Americans are using bicycles for transportation and recreation in record numbers. Factor in the fitness and the green movements, as well as high energy costs, and you've got yourself a two-wheel revolution.
And if you're part of that revolution, we'd love to hear from you. Are you a bike commuter or maybe a recreational cyclist? What about biking appeals to you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org and tell us why you made the switch from biking, from riding your car to biking. Ron Shear wrote this month's cover story in the Christian Science Monitor called The Bike Boom. And Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Well, you know, as you put it, Americans are having a sudden romance with their bicycles, and bicycles aren't necessarily new. So what's going on with the new love for biking?
I think there are lots of reasons, and Gene even touched on some of them, why people are getting back into bicycling again. And, you know, some of it is just we're fed up with the traffic. I don't know whether, probably Madison doesn't have traffic, but in New York City we have so much traffic. You know, the streets are clogged. Exercise, a lot of people, you know, you're chained to the desk, and there's no better way than to get on your two wheels and ride to work to get a little bit of exercise. And I know I talked to people who said that one of the reasons they did it was because they wanted to cut down on their emissions, of greenhouse gas emissions. There was one guy out in California, Ken Reed, who said he had been to see Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, and said, you know, Gore challenges people to change the way they do things. And so that was another reason that he did it. And then there was a guy, a doctor I talked to in Milwaukee, who said he likes to ride to work because it frees his mind. Is that he's, you know, we're all in these little boxes, and when you get out on your bike, you're a free spirit.
Yeah, first of all, I got to tell you, you'd be surprised. There is some traffic in Madison. I can vouch for that myself. If you can avoid the cows, then there's traffic. But besides the factors you just named there, it's not just, you know, individual choices that people are talking about. What about cities getting on board here?
Oh, cities are very happy to have this take place for any number of reasons. One is that cost effective. It costs so much less to install a bike lane than it does, you know, a mile of roadway for all, you know, for traffic, for cars. So it cuts down on their expenses. In New York City, for example, we're just building something called the Second Avenue Subway. We've been doing this for years. And it's going to cost up to $4.5 billion for just the first phase of it. And by way of contrast, in the story, we focused on a place called Long Beach, California. And Long Beach spent $25 million building bike lanes, dedicated bike lanes, and putting in bike racks in the downtown area and stuff like that. $25 million, most of which came from the federal government. So it cost them virtually nothing. And I know when the New York's bike share program, and I know you have a bike share program in Madison, but when New York's bike share program began, the Commissioner of Transportation here referred to it as the first new mass transit system in the city that we've had. Well, I know you've got I would call Madison's a great, probably modest bike share. We've got 6,000 bicycles on the bike share program already, going up to 10,000.
Oh, my. That's right. A lot of bike sharing going on.
It is. It is. And I will say, because I ride, I'm what I call an urban survival biker, in that I get on my bike and I go drive around the city to do things, and it's really kind of a survival sort of thing. But I see an awful lot of those bike shares out there now.
Now, can you lay some numbers on us, some statistics? Because it's not just a perception. I mean, it seems like people are into biking, but there are some real statistics to back this up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Commuting by bicycles was up 47% from 2000 to 2011. Okay. The largest bicycle place for bicycles in the city, or I should say in the country, is Portland, Oregon, where almost was it 16% of 6%? 6% of the commuters in Portland are biking, are coming, and that's a lot. In there will be 18 new cities with bike share programs this year. I think that probably there are places like San Francisco, I know, and it's another one, Seattle, both of whom have a significant bike bicycling going on in the cities.
So up 47% across the country, and I think what did your article say that among bike-friendly cities, you know, bike cities that already label themselves as being friendly places for bicycles, up 80%. I mean, This has to create some interesting challenges for cities when you're seeing that much traffic from bikes that are now sharing the road with cars and other vehicles.
Well, it is. I mean, because bicyclists are not always the most safety-oriented people. I think this has been a big issue as well in Madison. And so bicyclists tend to, when there's a red light, they'll do if they stop for the red light, it would be the exception rather than the rule. I think it's, New Yorkers are famous for jaywalking. I think this is called jayriding, you know, where you go through the red light. There probably are too many instances of bikers going through areas, at least here, where there are pedestrians crossing the street. So there's a tension. In fact, I mean, there's not any question that there's a lot of tension between drivers and bicyclists, and even drivers and pedestrians at times. It's something that I think as biking grows, maybe the bicycling community, I hope, will become sort of more mature about saying we have to obey the laws, we have to obey the rules.
Well, I guess you feel so free on the bike, it starts to feel maybe like the rules don't apply to you.
if only it were true. In New York, if the police decide to ticket you, and for every now and then they go on a ticketing drive, and if by your third ticket, the fine is up to $1,000.
Oh my gosh!
Right, and not only do you get a fine, but you get points on your driver's license. So it really becomes diminishing returns by the third time that you get ticketed. They were doing it in Central Park, I think it was last spring, when suddenly out of the blue the police arrived and decided they were going to start giving bicyclists tickets for going through the red lights in Central Park. And almost nobody pays any attention to those lights at all. So this was a big deal. And they finally backed off from it. And so people go right through the lights.
Now, how do the statistics, the numbers, I should say, for bike fatalities look? I know for cars, they're going down. Is the same true for bikes?
Well, they are not going down as fast as they are for cars. This is a problem, and it illustrates that there is a safety issue here. We found that bicycle fatalities between 2003 and 2011, the percentage of biking fatalities as a percentage of all traffic deaths was up by almost 24%. That's from the League of American Bicyclists.
Hmm.
So it's, it is a problem. Again, related to safety, I don't know, in Madison probably people wear bike helmets, bicyclist helmets here. In New York, I don't think that many people wear helmets.
Oh, it's interesting, because I kind of thought that was a universal message out there. Wear helmets, people.
You would think, but that's actually not the case. And in New York, it's not required.
So things are changing. As we see more bikes out there, we're kind of evolving how we think about bikes and bike safety. And we're talking right now with Ron Scheer about the bicycling boom in the United States. And we'd love to hear from you, too. Why do you bike? What do you love about biking and being on two wheels? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll hear from you right after the break. I'm Veronica Rickert with Jean Purcell, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with author and journalist Ron Shear about the bicycling boom taking place in this country. And we want to hear from you, too. Tell us why you bike. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And we've got full phone lines at the moment, so let's take our first call from Mike in Greenbush. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I try to bike commute once or twice a week, and you know, there's the obvious health benefits, but we're finding out that, you know, communities that embrace biking and walking transportation, there's a whole slew of side benefits. I mean, there's less congestion, a healthier workforce, and as your guest said earlier, that it's bike infrastructure is so much less expensive than road infrastructure. I commute into a blue-collar town. It's Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and we've seen, I think we mirror probably the national trend, because we've had an increase in the last couple of years. This was just measured through the non-motorized pilot program, of a 22% increase in bike commuting alone just over the past couple of years. So, but we were part of the non-motorized pilot program, which sponsored four programs across the country. So the infusion of very little money has led to, you know, enhanced transportation for pedestrians and bikers in this eastern part of Wisconsin over here near Sheboygan.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the perspective from Sheboygan, Mike. And what do you think? Does that sound about like what you're hearing, Ron?
Yes. In fact, I was going to say that in addition to what Mike had to say, is that communities like, for example, Long Beach, California, has said, we're hoping that this will help revitalize our downtown area. And so it'll bring more people in, and outside consultants come in and say, well, it does, because people, when you travel by a bike, you're moving at a human speed, you know, so you can look around and you can see that shop that's selling croissants, or you can see that shop that's selling something that you didn't notice it before. And if there's a bike rack, you might stop, you know, and buy something. And in fact, I think they found that bike-friendly downtown areas have a higher percentage of sales for the local merchants.
Yeah, you're moving at the, I guess, a slower speed, so you have time to smell the roses and do a little window shopping.
Exactly. Not only that, but you can't pile. It's not like you go to a big box store where you can pile stuff into the back of the SUV, you know, and then go home. Sometimes you have to buy maybe smaller amounts, more of a European style thing, where you buy what you need for today and take it home versus what you're going to need for the whole week.
Well, speaking of Europe, can you give us a sense of how the United States compares to Europe in terms of the number of people biking?
Oh, we're still in baby steps compared to them. Mm. I mean, for the Dutch, bicycles are 26% of their trips, okay? And don't forget, Portland was the highest with 6%. The Germans, it's 10%. So, you know, the Europeans are still way ahead of us in terms of that. And I mean, some of the, if you go to Amsterdam, you'll find that there are roads that are just designed with bike overpasses and things, so that bicyclists can get around more safely.
You know, we're such a car culture, though. At least that's what you hear. Maybe it's changing, that it's hard to imagine us reaching a number like 26%.
I think that it'll be a stretch for us to get that high. But again, there are some places, again, like Portland and places, where it's really becoming part of the culture. And people, it's a real mentality shift that's starting to take place, where people say, gee, I don't have to jump in the car in order to go buy something. I can get on the bicycle and I can go do it.
Well, I want to give a check of the Wisconsin numbers. Since 2000, biking in Wisconsin is up 188%.
Wow.
That's a pretty big number. That's from the League of American Bicyclists. We did fall from sixth place to eighth place in 2012 in the rankings of bike-friendly states, maybe just because we have more competition. But in general, it seems as though, you know, biking is up in Wisconsin. So I want to go to our next caller now. We've got Reggie joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Reggie.
How you doing?
Good. How about you?
I'm good.
What do you think about bikes?
Well, I wanted to share a story about my father. He, early in my life, I'm 27 now, so probably when I was about 10 or a little younger, he rode his bike from, I don't know if you know the Milwaukee area, but from Milwaukee to Brookfield for work, and that's quite a ride.
Yeah.
He did that for years, and then he got a job in Milwaukee, and he just never stopped. He's been a janitor for probably a better part of 12 years or something like that, and he basically would ride his bike to and from work. Sometimes he would make that one-way trip four times to let his dog out. I did the math, and it's just a rough estimate, but I did the math, and within the last somewhere around 15 years, he's ridden his bike over somewhere between 15 and like 18,000 miles.
Wow.
And now that, you know, early in our lives it was from necessity. He just couldn't afford another car, but now that he can, both of his kids are out of the house, he can afford a new car or a car for himself, and he just refuses. And he's told me several times if somebody took his bike and his right to ride his bike, he would just cry. Yeah, I mean,
so he really loved his biking. Did he pass that on to you? Are you a big biker too?
I work in the summer. When I'm in school in the fall and spring, I ride to the park and ride and then take the bus because it's free. I don't have to pay for parking. But I don't ride to the extent that he does, but I try, and I've gone on bike rides with him, and it's something we enjoy to do together.
Yeah, well, what a cool story! Thank you, Reggie, for sharing that and telling us about your dad.
In fact, Veronica, let me just say that one of the cool things that Reggie just touched on is that bicycling has become a family event. So mothers and fathers can take their kids, and they can all four of them can go, you know, can go off riding.
Yeah. Do you do that with your family?
Unfortunately, not. I don't have a family, and B, my wife doesn't ride a bicycle. But it's something that other people can do.
Yeah, we just started doing that as a family. My son is 8, and he just learned, and we've taken our first family bike rides. The first one, he literally rode off the path into the ditch, but we surmounted that, and we went on a second ride. And yeah, it is a nice thing to do as a family, just like Reggie's talking about there. So,
the one other thing that Reggie touched on, which is another one of the trends, is that bicycling is not just something that educated college, you know, when you see in college towns or something like that happening, bicycling is happening across the entire spectrum. So blue-collar workers, African-Americans, Hispanics, it's really across the board that we're seeing increases in bicycling.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Reggie. Let's take one more call. I think we have time for Susan in Kenosha. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
I was listening to your show, and I'm a very avid bike rider. I've been biking since I was a little kid. I grew up in New York, and so the helmet was basically my mother saying, "What? Be careful. You fell off your bike?" And that's what you get. But I think that some of the problem you were talking about earlier about between, you know, the tension between cyclists and motorists and pedestrians, I think that is a natural thing that has to happen because when there are no bicycling paths. I know that it's an uncomfortable thing to have to make room for that sort of thing in municipalities, but the fact is that a bicycle, although it is legally treated as a vehicle in most municipalities that I've stayed in, no bicyclist, and I'm sure that you agree with this, is going to pull out into traffic and try to act as though they're in a car, unless they're just efficient in some way. I mean, it's just dangerous. And although, I mean, a bicycle is just, it's not a motor vehicle. It's a different animal. It's certainly not, it is not pedestrian traffic, but I think you'd agree that you could make a closer comparison to pedestrian traffic than you could that it is actually more like a motor vehicle, although legally it's treated that way.
Right.
And so, you know, as a consequence, you know, you were saying that, you know, maybe the freedom goes to our head and we feel like the rules don't apply to us. But I think when I've looked at some of the bike laws that there are in places I've stayed, I cannot in good conscience actually obey these laws, you know, when I ride, I ride on the left-hand side of the road so that I can see cars coming toward me. Partly it's because I'm a woman And if you've ridden a bike or walked on a street, you know that cars coming from behind you. Every 20th one is going to be somebody who wants to beep at you.
Let's see what our guest Ron has to say. We've got about 30 seconds, Ron. What do you think?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that, and I think Susan's right, is that women like to ride, especially in areas where they're protected. And so we find in communities that set up bike paths that are protected from the vehicles that more women ride their bicycles. And I think it's important to get more women on the wheels, if you will. And so I think that's an important point.
Well, Ron, it's a great trend. We'll be watching it. Thank you so much for talking about it with us today.
Pleasure.
That was author and journalist Ron Scheer, and we've got a link to his piece, The Bike Boom, on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we hope you'll continue the conversation there. And hey, post a picture of you and your bike. Spandex is totally optional.
Coming up next, we'll be talking about all things Ramadan. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in this week for Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in this week for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up, we'll be talking with Scott Bauer of the Associated Press about yesterday's federal injunction of Wisconsin's new abortion law. But first, Ramadan began at sundown last night.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. It's the month during which Muslims believe the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. And to mark it, Muslims around the world fast from sunup to sundown. And here with us to talk about the meaning of Ramadan and how it's observed here in the U.S. is Asra Nomani. Asra was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal for 15 years and is the author of Standing Alone in Mecca. Asra, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much.
So how would you describe the meaning of Ramadan in Islam?
Well, I think it's basically like a spiritual boot camp. You know, for 30 days, you refrain from food and drink, sex, and other ideas like gambling or gossiping from basically before sunup to sundown. One of my cousins was telling me she ends up ending the month with a spiritual high.
So you describe it as spiritual boot camp. Is the idea to cleanse yourself, to live with less?
It really is try to simplify your life, to really go back to the essential core of your ruh. It's a word that means your soul, your spirit. And, you know, of course, everybody needs to eat and drink to be alive. And so, you know, we have food then before sunup and after sundown. But it's to sort of show yourself sacrifice and to see what it is that is essential in life and what it is that is essential in your life.
How does it feel to go through that month? Do you start out with one mentality and emerge with another?
Well, I think, you know, like all things, you never really know what's going to happen. You get tested both physically because you feel the kind of irritations that happen with food deprivation or dehydration. I mean, there's physiological things that happen within a person, and you really have to figure out how to calm yourself, how to be tempered, because really during this month, you're supposed to be the best of what you can be. You're supposed to rise to the highest standards of life. And, you know, the month is marked in the Muslim calendar as the month in which the Prophet Muhammad received the revelations for the Quran. And so the idea is that this is a month in which you, too, are connected to this higher experience that's beyond the worldly existence.
Now, you've observed Ramadan in the United States and other places in the world. What is it like? How does it compare?
Well, you know, in the U.S., it's really your private experience and your family experience. In other parts of the world where there are Muslim majority countries, it's a societal experience. I had a lot of fun, and I have had a lot of fun practicing it in the U.S. because you involve your friends. When I worked at the Wall Street Journal, one year the sun would set right around deadline, unfortunately after deadline. And so I would be taxed, you know, finishing my stories and filing them. and then the sun would go down. And then what I would do is order samosas, nice dish, you know, from my native India, mm-hmm. and have what I called a break fast club. And so all my friends who weren't practicing the fast enjoyed it because they got, you know, this nice treat, and I had the joy of their company.
Oh, that sounds like a nice way to observe. And if you were observing it in India, what would it have been like? You said it was more societal. What would that have felt like?
Well, in India or in Pakistan, you know, where in India Muslims are still a minority, and in Pakistan, where it's a majority country, what you have is, you know, the entire city and the hubbub of the country really, you know, kind of chilling out during the day, and then at sun up, you know, you see this buzz in everybody's homes because everybody's having their meals right before you see the sliver of the light. And then at sundown, you always know everybody's going to be home, or they might be at these little tea shops and other places to break their fast. I really enjoyed it. In Pakistan, they have Pizza Hut. So I would go for my my early morning meal sometimes at the Pizza Hut.
At Pizza Hut?
Yeah, exactly. So that was like really unique experience. And then other times, you know, they're bowling alleys. So they, you know, the entire industry of consumers gets involved. And so you have your breakfast meal at the Pizza Hut, and you go bowling out.
Wow.
at the Area 51 bowling alley down the road.
That is different.
Yeah.
So you have a sweet memory, don't you, of your father waking you up for Ramadan?
All through my childhood, you know, I'm 48 now. And so when I was a kid, Bruce Jenner, right, before the nose job, was on, on the Wheaties box. I was a runner, and I would always have my Wheaties every morning for breakfast. And what my dad would do then is come and wake me up. And we would both sit there with our bowls of Wheaties, you know, and Bruce Jenner, and have this quiet moment, because it's such a really special time, you know, before the sun has come up for any early risers.
It is.
Yeah. You know, the birds are just waking up, and there's just a stillness in the air. And you know, I just love that. And it's like one of my fondest memories from my childhood.
And you thought a lot about going deeper into Ramadan. How have you deepened your observance over the years?
Well, you know, in the Ramadan of 2003, it was the eve of Ramadan when in my hometown in Morgantown, West Virginia, we were opening up a new mosque. And I went to the mosque excited with the rest of the community to start the month the next day. And that night, one of the elders stood at the front door and he said, "Asra, take the back door," because like so many mosques in this country, you know, two out of three mosques, women are sitting in a segregated area. In our mosque in Morgantown, we had to go through a back door. And I stood there and I thought, wow, this is not right. You know, in this country where I'd grown up with separate is not equal. And I walked through the front door, and that entire month I was in the mosque while we did these special night prayers called Tarawih prayers. And what we usually do is read the Quran. What I read during that month was scholarly works on reinterpreting the Quran from a feminist perspective. And it was really during that month that I came to understand feminist principles in Islam and how we were denying them in our communities too often. And I realized also that, you know, inside each of one of ourselves, like we really, the deepest struggle that we could have, our deepest jihad, as we call it, is to be better people, to be better communities, and to serve those who are in need. And I realized that, you know, a lot of these external practices that we do, from fasting to other rituals, are sometimes done without the pursuit of these higher principles. And so my deeper soul searching that began that Ramadan and continues to today is that it's not just about, you know, abstaining from food and water during the day. It's about rising to your higher self and to me, it's not as you know, the deepest benefit that we could get from this month is to try to figure out how to be better citizens of this world. And so we actually are having conversations that would be considered, you know, complete heresy in many communities, many conservative Orthodox communities, where people are saying, you know what, it's not as important to fast as it is to really just be a good citizen and to learn to do that every day of our lives so that we can make this world a better place.
Well, Asra, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Ramadan with us. Appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Asra Nomani, a journalist and author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam.
Coming up next, we'll check the headlines, and then we'll hear from AP reporter Scott Bauer on the recent federal injunction of Wisconsin's new abortion law. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last Friday, Governor Scott Walker signed a controversial abortion bill into law. The law requires women to receive an ultrasound before having an abortion, and it also requires that doctors who perform abortions have hospital admitting privileges.
But yesterday, federal judge William Conley put a freeze on the part of the law requiring doctors to have hospital admitting privileges. And here with us to discuss the injunction in the law is Scott Bauer, the Associated Press reporter based in Wisconsin. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with a little bit of background on the law itself. This type of legislation is something that, as I understand it, is happening around the country. I know there's legislation going on in Texas, North Dakota, Ohio, and Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. It's an idea that's being introduced around the country, and here in Wisconsin it came up very quickly. The bill was introduced in early June. It passed the legislature in 9 days. And the governor signed it on Friday, the day after the 4th of July holiday, and with little fanfare, just announcing it in a press release that went out Friday afternoon.
And the legislation in Wisconsin, let's talk about specifically what it was would have done, because the legislation around the country is similar in some regards in terms of restricting access. But in Wisconsin, what were we talking about?
There are two main parts of it. The first part requires any woman seeking an abortion to first have an ultrasound performed and to have the results of that ultrasound made available to her to see. The second requirement was that doctors performing abortions must have hospital-admitting privileges within 30 miles of the clinic where they perform the abortion. So the argument among supporters was that would provide a higher level of care, that doctors ought to have admitting privileges and they could follow their patient, if need be, to the hospital. But those who challenged the law pointed out a number of problems with that, one of which was, a number of doctors don't have hospital admitting privileges because they don't admit very many patients. And so the real goal, they argued, was to limit the number of doctors who could perform abortions in the state.
Yeah, and as I understand the idea behind admitting privileges, it's not as easy as a physician just going to a hospital, showing them their diploma or qualifications, and then getting them. I mean, there's a process there. And some quotas, apparently, that they've got to meet in terms of admitting a certain number of patients and so forth.
Yeah, the attorney, one of the attorneys who brought the case, Lester Pines, said after the hearing yesterday that really he believed the intent was to put these doctors in the catch-22, and that if they do good work, they don't admit very many women to the hospital because they aren't, that extra care is not needed. But in order to get admitting privileges to hospitals, you have to admit a certain number of patients. So the way Pines presented the argument, it was that these doctors would almost be put in an impossible situation.
So which groups filed the lawsuit and challenged this?
Well, the lawsuit was filed by Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and also by Affiliated Medical Services, which runs a clinic in Milwaukee. And Affiliated had said that under the law, its clinic would have to close because its doctors were not do not have the admitting privileges. And Planned Parenthood had said that its clinic in Appleton would have to close for the same reason. And if that indeed had happened, that would leave the state with, it would go from 4 to 2 clinics where abortions could be performed, one clinic in Madison and one in Milwaukee.
And we should clarify here, the judge ruled on an injunction on just a portion of this legislation?
Yeah, that's correct. The lawsuit that was brought did not challenge the ultrasound requirement, so that provision of the law went into effect on Monday and remains in effect. The only portion that was challenged and that was temporarily put on hold is the admitting privileges requirement. So there's a hearing on July 17th where they will discuss the request for a preliminary injunction. What happened yesterday was a temporary restraining order.
All right. So, and the judge's decision, you can find it on a number of news sites right now. It's fairly lengthy, but from your reading of it, Scott Bauer, what were some of the key points?
Well, it was interesting that the judge ruled as quickly as he did, because the hearing yesterday kind of came together very quickly in that he had set the July 17th date for the actual hearing on the temporary restraining order preliminary injunction request, and this was thrown together yesterday afternoon. Initially, it was to be a phone conference call, and then it was in court. And the attorneys for Planned Parenthood had requested quick action because they had a number of women who had appointments scheduled for this week that would have to be canceled. The judge, the hearing ended around 3 o'clock, and the judge wouldn't commit to offering anything immediately other than he said he would rule by Tuesday morning. Well, at 6 o'clock, he put out an 18-page order that was pretty detailed in terms of his analysis of the law and some of the problems he saw with the constitutionality of this admitting privileges requirement. So it was pretty clear that he had done some work ahead of time and was leaning towards something before the hearing actually came out. And the ruling, you know, is pretty clear in saying that the state failed so far to show that there's any benefit to the maternal health of the mother in requiring that these doctors have admitting privileges. That was the issue the judge really focused on in the hearing and wanted the attorneys to speak to, was how does this requirement benefit the health of the mother.
And so where does the state go from here?
Well, the state, in their defense, was arguing that they had very little time to prepare to present arguments on Monday. The assistant attorney general who was there said that he intends to call expert witnesses who will testify to the fact that it is to the benefit of the health of the mother that the doctors have hospital admitting privileges. Certainly they'll try to put evidence up to that fact to build that record. And the other side is also saying they're prepared to put up their own experts to say just the opposite.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about that reaction as you described the process that happened yesterday with Judge Conley. It happened in a hurry, but it sounds like both sides were ready and both sides are responding already.
Yeah, I mean, it's a situation, and the judge commented on it, that even though this is all happening very quickly with the bill signed on Friday, the hearing on Monday, the temporary restraining order issued Monday night, that both sides were very clear in what was going to happen. The opponents of the law said they were going to challenge it in court immediately, which they did. Supporters of the law, Wisconsin Right to Life, and groups of from that side of the issue were very clear in saying they expected legal challenges and they expect to prevail ultimately. So, and even the attorneys yesterday, you know, this restraining order is good for 9 or 10 days until that hearing on the 17th. And even then, everyone seems to agree that this is ultimately going to go to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
And I'm wondering, when you say that, other legislators, legislatures around the country watching this process, do you think?
I'm sure there are, as you mentioned, given the number of other laws that are very similar and working their way through the process. I haven't taken a close look at all of those, but I would imagine at some point you may see some of these consolidated, or you may see something ultimately going through the federal appeals court process and maybe to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So what happens then to the remainder of the legislation, the ultrasound portion of that? That simply remains in effect, or is there a possibility that that could be challenged as well?
that remains in effect. Of course, there's always a possibility that could be challenged as well. There's nothing to date that's been filed on that, but again, the law has only been in effect for a couple days. So it's possible you could see a legal challenge of that as well.
So looking ahead to, what is it, July 17th is the hearing?
That's the hearing, and it's possible that you'll see almost like a little mini trial. As of last night, the attorneys weren't sure yet if witnesses would actually be called, but it seemed highly possible that would happen. If not, you would certainly have depositions submitted as part of the record. And it will be a little more lengthy of laying out of the evidence, and certainly the state will have, I think, more to offer than they did yesterday to defend the law, and we'll see. I mean, the judge was pretty clear where he was headed in the order he put out yesterday, so I think the state will certainly have the burden to try to convince him otherwise.
So keep our eyes open for July 17th.
That's right.
All right, Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime.
We've been talking with Scott Bauer, a reporter for the Associated Press here in Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll discuss how the produce we eat today has fewer nutrients than that same produce did in the past.
And coming up tomorrow, too, we're also going to be speaking with Chris Chloe. He is arguably the most famous punter in the NFL. We'll be talking with him about sports, online activism, and what it's like to embrace your inner nerd.
And we'll hear about an organization that's trying to increase the level of diversity in children's books.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.